propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us. The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
We're pleased to welcome back into the bunker the brothers Collins, Paul and Philip Collins, authors of a new article called The Ruling Class-Sponsored Race War and the Balkanization of America. Fellas, welcome back to PID Radio.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Now, your article makes some interesting connections here between the Minutemen down on the border and some very powerful forces, powerful in that they are sponsoring some elements that the Minutemen may not want to be associated with. Do I have the sense of that right?
You have that absolutely correct. This whole article, since it's come out, it's drawn some flack from some people that just either didn't read the article or didn't understand what we were trying to get at with it. The whole goal is not the dissolution of the Minutemen. Instead, the goal is to save the Minutemen from these subversive elements that are beginning to insinuate themselves into the movement, and more importantly, these elements, the people that are behind these elements, keeping them out of the loop. We're talking about some white supremacist groups and some neo-Nazi types, but those who hide behind them within the power elite that are pulling the strings of the neo-Nazis. We want to keep them out of the sphere of influence when it comes to the Minutemen as well. So the whole plan, the whole drive behind this article was basically to save the Minutemen by encouraging them to periodically do some house cleaning and to purge their own ranks, so that what's happened to other groups doesn't happen to them, because this has happened with groups before. A group who gets started up with good intentions, some whistleblowing group, a group such as the John Birch Society or something along that line, and then somebody will come in, or some other organization will begin to insinuate itself into the fold, and before you know it, there's all of a sudden a wolf in the hen house, and it renders the group either impotent or turns the group in a different direction, in a very sinister direction, towards an agenda that it was never intended for.
The Minutemen are basically what? Just a sort of an ad hoc border patrol?
Well, yeah, it's basically a movement made up of middle class, I'd say middle class Americans who are concerned about border patrol and are concerned about the fact that there's been a just lackluster attempt to keep illegals from coming over, and so they've basically lent their assistance to watching the borders and have gotten out there and basically made sure that these illegals are watched and that they don't get across, as of yet, there hasn't been any kind of acts of vigilante justice, so to speak. Nobody's been shot, so far as I understand. You know, they just pass it along to the U.S. Border Patrol that, you know, that there's illegals moving across the border in this area or that area, and it's had some success, and so it's not at all unusual or uncommon that when you start to have success, a success rate, you know, that somebody wants to pull the whole thing apart.
Now, so they just basically go out there with communications equipment and notify the Border Patrol when they spot somebody coming across.
Yes, yes.
So are they doing citizens' arrest, or
or not?
I believe that they have been able to, from what I understand from Joe McCutcheons, who's been on the Michael Corbin show with him, they do hold them in custody and whatnot, but they really leave it up to the U.S. Border Patrol to adjudicate and to, you know, and to do any kind of official kind of, you know, work like arrest, like a, you know, whatever it takes, you know, to get them back where they belong.
Well, you know, in their defense, the Minutemen are not these angry white guys that are just, you know, hating the Mexican people. Not all of them are Mexican, though.
Yeah.
Hating the darker-skinned people who are trying to come across over into the United States. It isn't that, I don't think. From the way I understand this, they really are in fear for their lives because in some cases, the Mexican army is coming over and actually shooting at people on their own ranches.
Yeah, and part of the concern is apart from just immigration levels going unchecked, part of the concern is that with some of the illegal immigration that's taking place, more radical elements are coming over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not to say that every migrant worker is a terrorist or is a criminal, but there are some radical elements that are coming over with the illegal immigration. For instance, the Aslan movement, which holds that the entire Southwest United States belongs to Chicano, and
mm-hmm.
they adhere to a supremacy doctrine that is not unlike that of the Nazis. They basically believe that the Southwest Western United States has to be reclaimed by force if necessary, and that they'll establish a Chicano empire in that region and drive all other races out. And I mean all other races, all races other than Chicano. The Brown Berets, which is an organization that's been tied to the Voice of Aslan, also espoused similar beliefs. They basically have been associated with anti-Semitism, also very anti-black sentiments. The Voice of Aslan had also been accused of promulgating several conspiracy theories that Jews were responsible for the anthrax attacks shortly after 9/11. So this radical element that's coming over with the illegal immigration, that's part of what has citizen activists like the Minutemen concerned. And it's predominantly not, it's not really a racial concern. It's not a concern that is drawn along racial lines, but it is in fact a concern for America and for the preservation of Americanism and national sovereignty and border integrity. And that's the distinction that has to be drawn, and that's the distinction that's being confused by the insinuation of this racist fifth column that's attempting to kind of co-opt the Minutemen.
So this, the fifth column, as you call them, they're trying to foster hatred, us versus them mentality. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And as Paul previously mentioned, many of these racist elements have behind them, are financed or controlled or both by some factions of the power elite. And this is by no means an old strategy, a new strategy. This is a very old strategy that the power elite have used in the past. It's been used, for instance, it was used by the communists very well. Marshal Tito was able to ride into dominance astride racial discord. And so it's being used now here in the United States as a way of basically sabotaging real grassroots activism and also creating a politically and socially expedient racial dialectic.
Basically, to build a racial dialectic,
dialectic, to get some kind of a race war going, because and as we get into the body and the meat of this evidence during the interview, this will become more apparent. Not only do we have puppeteers behind the white supremacists that are insinuating themselves into the Minutemen, but we have elite puppeteers behind the radical Chicano groups, behind the Aztlan cult. And so you have two sides being played against one another by the same power elite.
Now, this goes back to the eugenics movement, too, doesn't it, that started in California?
Yes, it certainly does. It basically ties in through a character by the name of Tanton.
Perhaps before we go into Tanton, to start it off, and all, we should go to Glenn Spencer. And when this started back when I did a radio program with Michael Corbin on his show, A Closer Look. I was basically on his show doing an interview about my article, Neocon Court Coup in the Politics of Disaster Revisited.
Mm-hmm.
And during that interview, Michael got with me off the air, and he had asked me if I had ever seen this video called A Line in the Sand. And I told him no, I wasn't aware of it. And Michael, he's very much involved in the whole immigration issue, and he's very passionate about it. So
right.
He gets a hold of anything and everything pertaining to that. And so he had got himself a copy of this video that dealt with the immigration issue called A Line in the Sand. And he's shown, and so he passed along scenes from it to me. And early on in the video, Jim Gilchrist and Chris Simcox from the Minutemen shows up on the video and are interviewed. And that's benign and, you know, simple enough. And, you know, nothing wrong there. But then later on in the video, an individual named Kevin MacDonald gets on. And he's a evolutionary psychologist, so big red flags start to go up.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts talking about how it's immigration after 1924 and these Jewish people that began to immigrate to the United States that caused this problem. Then after him, there's another guy named Alex Linder. Now, Alex Linder is a lot more blatant, and he's just a forthright white supremacist from the Vanguard Network. And he begins to give his little spiel on the video. So Michael was basically afraid that these white supremacist elements were starting to get involved with the Minutemen as a result of what he had seen on this video, because he did not believe that Gilchrist, Simcox should be on, which should share the same podium as somebody from Vanguard or Kevin MacDonald. And so he called up Glenn Spencer and asked Glenn Spencer, who is head of American Border Patrol and and works with the Minutemen, about this video, and brought it to his attention that there was racist elements on it. And Glenn Spencer really didn't have any problems with it or qualms with it.
Mm.
So Michael asked us to look into it and see if we could find any kind of racist kind of element there. So we started with Glenn Spencer because he seemed to just blow off Michael's concerns. And what we found was that Glenn Spencer had been supported his American Border Patrol since 1992 by this individual named John Tanton in his funding arm. And John Tanton leads back into eugenics and all of that stuff. And I'll let Phil give his complete resume and everything over to him.
Yeah, essentially this is where the eugenics and population control agenda begins to take shape. John Tanton has established a multi-headed hydra of organizations, one of which is called the Social Contract Press. And it's an organization which concerns themselves with, and I'm quoting straight from their website now, quote, population size and rate of growth, protection of the environment and precious resources, limits on immigration, as well as preservation and promotion of a shared American language and culture, unquote. Now, many of the web links on the Social Contract Press website include carrying capacity network, negative population growth, and population and sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in case, you know, for the listener who hasn't discerned the theme yet, obviously the theme is connected to Malthusian science and basically the theories of carrying capacity, that the Earth has a finite carrying capacity, that there has to be population control measures implemented because too many people means famine, starvation, death, which is all problematic and all theoretical and has been virtually proven to be bunk by several other more qualified demographers and what have you. But evidently, Tanton, one of his passions is population control. And, of course, population control has historical ties with the eugenics movement. Tanton chaired the National Sierra Club Population Committee from 1971 to 1974. He was on the National Board of Zero Population Growth from 1973 to 1978. And from 1975 to 1977, he also served the term as president on the zero population growth. Well, zero population growth was founded by none other than Paul Ehrlich, who wrote the book The Population Bomb.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, this book is just, if you want a great laugh, you know, you'd sit down with this book, because there's no better example of Chicken Little science. This book was filled to the brim with just phony baloney eschatological claims, amongst many of which was that the 1970s would see mass starvation, famine, we'd eventually see the death of all the world's oceans, and of course with the arrival of the 70s, all of Paul Ehrlich's prognostications were proven false.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul Ehrlich was given an audience by none other than George Bush Sr., who during his congressional career had the Republican Task Force on Earth Resources and Population, and Ehrlich's wife is a member of the Club of Rome, which is an elite organization devoted to population control, and it was founded by an Italian Freemason named Aurelio Pacechi. And Aurelio Pacechi has been quoted as saying that on occasions that he's felt like, quote-unquote, Weishaupt reincarnated. But at any rate, the population control movement has had historical ties with the eugenics movement, and essentially eugenics is selective breeding for the purposes of facilitating human evolution.
Mm-hmm.
The term was coined by Sir Francis Galton, who was Charles Darwin's cousin, and essentially eugenics is premised upon Darwinism, which is an occult doctrine of becoming disseminated on the popular level as an ostensible science, and many have attempted to characterize eugenics as some sort of ideological aberration that attached itself to evolutionary theory. However, Charles Darwin commended his cousin Galton, saying that genius, quote-unquote, tends to be inherited. So, moreover, Darwin also quoted Galton extensively in The Descent of Man, and evolution was always first and foremost a social theory advocating an elitist society where the class distinction was predominantly genetic. And this was the vision to which the eugenics movement, which began here in the United States and predominantly in California, and really took flight in Germany pre-World War II, this was the vision to which they were committed, and it's also the vision to which John Tanton is committed.
And when you've got a group of immigrants coming across the border who are predominantly Roman Catholic, which discourages the use of population control, birth control methods, you've got antagonism built in.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Because the fear of the guys in the population control, the eugenics movement, is that we're going to be overrun by all these brown-skinned people.
Exactly, which they basically qualify in eugenical language as dysgenics. But also, if, if you look at why Tanton concerns himself also with the immigration issue, John Tanton is what's known as a neo-Malthusian, which is essentially a variant of Malthus's theories regarding population and population pressure. And basically, neo-Malthusians really have a great deal of disdain for pro-fertility belief systems. And of course, Hispanic immigrants come from predominantly Catholic countries, and Catholicism is a pro-fertility belief system. Now, neo-Malthusians contend that pro-fertility adherents will have more children, which will, in turn, ensure the continuity of a pro-fertility tradition in future generations. So the neo-Malthusian believes that this continuing selection for pro-fertility is pretty much analogous to the continuing evolutionary selection for beneficial genes. So you immediately identify the eugenical character of neo-Malthusian ideology. Neo-Malthusians believe that increased fertility will result in what they call a hyper-exponential population growth. And while immigrants can contribute to economic production, neo-Malthusians argue that economic production will experience really little or no increase. And so inevitably, economic production will be outstripped by fertility of the population, and this will lead to what they call a Malthusian check, and subsistence levels will be stabilized, but only after mass starvation and death. And this is the bizarre Chicken Little type of science, the eschatology to which John Tanton and many others who are associated with him, like Paul Ehrlich, are committed. And by the John Tanton was also former president of the Northern Michigan Planned Parenthood. And for those who haven't done their homework into Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, who was the founder of the organization, was a supporter of the eugenical policies of Nazi Germany. Ernest Rudin, who was part of Hitler's racial hygiene program, also wrote for Sanger's magazine, Birth Control Review. Birth Control Review has ran several articles in its past over the need for compulsory sterilization, for segregation of specific populations. Margaret Sanger herself advocated the establishment of a gulag system here in the United States for the segregation of the feeble-minded, for what she called the human weeds, for dysgenics. And this, again, this ties in with the sort of thinking that individuals like John Tanton harbor.
It sounds like Brave New World.
Exactly, absolutely. And it's interesting because Julian Huxley, the brother of Aldous Huxley, who authored Brave New World, was a eugenicist. UNESCO, one of its primary missions was eugenical in character. And Huxley, Julian Huxley, in addition to being a eugenicist and an evolutionist, coined the term transhumanism, which transhumanism is basically the belief that the human species will continue its evolution through technological augmentation, through nanotechnology, through neurotechnology, through biotechnology, and we will eventually arrive at what they call a post-human condition. And the post-human condition is a condition where essentially humanity will cease to be human. This really kind of reiterates the old mantra of Nietzsche, where he wrote in Thus Spake Zarathustra, where he said, man is something to be overcome. And it's also a reiteration of Gnostic occultism, because it holds that essentially the physical body is a little more than an impediment to the acquisition of human knowledge. It's a prosthetic to be mastered. The only difference between transhumanism and Gnosticism is, as opposed to the acknowledgement of a soul, they substitute for that a information pattern, and basically it's a secular Gnosticism in that sense.
This is mind-numbing in its intricacy.
It is.
And hats off and headphones off to you guys for doing the research and digging all this out. I know there's more here because I've read through the article, and we've got more connections to the power elite, the intelligence communities on both sides, the Aslan movement and the neo-Nazi movement that is infiltrating the Minuteman organizations. And we will get into that in some detail when we continue with PID Radio right after this. Well, 30 minutes right on the dot.
You're so good.
Who's your daddy?
Okay. You know, when you were talking about that stuff, I was thinking about we've had...
We're back on PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert, and we're with the Collins brothers.
Paul and Philip discussing their article, The Ruling Class-Sponsored Race War and the Balkanization of America.
That's a lot to say. But you know, there's a lot to this.
Yeah.
I guess you need a big title to cover this big subject.
Yes, it conveys the weight of the subject matter.
it does.
But no, we were talking about John Tanton and his connections to the power elite and getting into even, the Club of Rome, which has some implications for worldwide intelligence.
We don't have enough time to go in that direction.
With the Club of Rome, yeah. But who is behind John Tanton, or there, as far as his handlers are concerned? I mean, does he have people in the, is it in the government, or just members of the wealthy elite that are pulling the strings?
Who are the puppeteers?
Tanton himself is actually pulling the strings of one guy in government that we know of, Tom Tancredo.
Really?
You note that in February, on February 13th of 2002, at the Cannon House office building in Washington, D.C., there was a open house meeting on over immigration, and Tom Tancredo spoke at this meeting, and the meeting was put together by none other than Tanton. And Tanton's Numbers USA has two staff members that claim to have worked out of the office of Representative Tom Tancredo, Rosemary Jenks and Linda Pardue, who are lobbyists for Numbers USA.
Now Tancredo has a reputation as being one who's tough on border control. Does he know what Tanton is into, or is he part of the group here?
Well, let me put it this way. I did a show with Michael Corbin on October 3rd of this year over the issue, a three-hour show, and then Philip and I got back on the air a week later with Michael, and as I understand it, after we did those shows, the Tancredo's lawyer had obviously listened in. He has been a frequent guest on Michael's shows in the past.
Right.
And his lawyer, Phil Sheldon, called Vanguard and the Vanguard Network, which is the Nazis, the neo-Nazis, Alex Linder and whatnot, and demanded that they take him off of their website, take him off of their videos, and all, because he didn't want to have anything to do with them. However, there's no evidence that we can find that as of yet that he has denied any money from Tanton's network or has began to hold John Tanton at arm's length. And Michael has not had Tom Tancredo back on his show, and I understand that Tom Tancredo now has a do not respond on his email when it comes to Michael's messages.
Huh.
So it's great that we could get rid of these more blatant elements, but then a more subtle kind of guy like Tanton, he hasn't gotten rid of that influence over his career, and that's a really scary thing given the fact that he's the chair of the Congressional Immigration Reform Caucus.
Right, exactly.
And all. So we see Tanton controlling at least one politician there. We know that with a memo that he sent out to his one organization, FAIR, he says right up front in words of one syllable that one of the goals is to subvert the representative side of government. So
he also mandated he used the language infiltration of the judicial branch.
That's correct. Yeah.
What an interesting choice of words.
If that's his goal, and if you know Compton Credo hasn't said no to anything that in terms of Canton's support, then it's safe to say that he's probably in part been successful with that infiltration and subversion and all. But behind Canton, we found several different influences that led to the very power elite that several members of the Minutemen would have objection to. And one of those sources in the elite was none other than the Smith-Richardson Foundation. Now, the Smith-Richardson Foundation leads into Skull and Bones, it leads into Nazi sympathizers, and it leads into the Bush family dynasty. And the Bush family knew the Richardson and his wife through General Robert E. Wood, who was Sears and Roebuck's chairman. And General Wood had set up an organization known as America First, and they had basically been against the war with Hitler's Germany, and they characterized America's going against Hitler as America joining the communists. And of course, there's a line to be drawn there. You know, being opposed to fascism doesn't necessarily make you a communist.
No, especially since both of those government systems are socialist, right?
Exactly.
It's just different flavors of socialism.
Yeah, it's essentially what they were doing was they were basically exploiting legitimate domestic concerns with communism, but kind of reframing the discourse in a dialectical framework. So what that does is it places fascism on one end of the spectrum, communism on the other, and now the question posed is which dictatorship do you choose?
Right, exactly, and that's kind of the way it's still presented today. You know, you've got the Hitler on the right and Stalin on the left. It's like, no, they're both on the left. They're both on the left. It's the same thing that got us into the mess with Saddam Hussein. If you're against Hussein, you're for the Ayatollah.
Yeah. And when a person thinks along dialectical lines, it's like a form of I would characterize it as mental sabotage or intellectual neutering, because the individual no longer thinks in terms of right and wrong, and no longer in terms of what's reasonable, what's right. They think in terms of artificial extremes that really don't exist, or at least don't exist in the framework, the conceptual framework that dialectical thinking presents them in. So again, it's like a person who is basically sabotaged and is locked within the four walls of their own mind and of their own thinking.
Now that you've let that secret out, we have to kill you.
Yeah.
I use that in sales all the time. Do you want 20 tons of pipe or 40? Oh!
But the funny thing is that Richardson's wife was also a relative of Nancy Linghorne. And Nancy Linghorne had married Lord Astor. And if you'll remember, Lord Astor had been a supporter of the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
But the Smith-Richardson Foundation was organized by Eugene Stetson Jr., who was Richardson's son-in-law and who had worked for Prescott Bush as an assistant manager at Brown Brothers Harriman. And Stetson was also a member of the Skull and Bones. He was initiated from 1934. But also we see behind the Smiths and Richardson's Foundation connections to the U.S. intelligence community because the Smith and Richardson's group had financed the Bridgewater Hospital in Massachusetts. Its experimentations that were involved in the MK Ultra project. Mind control thing. And the Smith-Richardson Foundation also has what is known as the Center for Creative Leadership, Europe. And this center trains Central Intelligence Agency and Secret Service members and basically put these employees through a kind of psychodrama at these at this facility. And then another office that the Center for Creative Leadership has is in none other than Langley, Virginia, at the headquarters of the Central Intelligence Agency. So here we see power elite and the intelligence community coming in.
Didn't they also, the Smith and Richardson Foundation, didn't they also give some money to the Council on Foreign Relations?
That's correct. They also have given $883,073 to the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a big elite organization here in the United States.
Essentially, it's essentially the stateside branch of the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which was birthed from the Rhodes Roundtable groups, and really acts as this this country's foreign policy cartel.
But the connections back to the Central Intelligence Agency and to the power elite become even more painfully obvious when you go into the Scaife family. The Scaife Foundation gave about $1.4 million to Canton's Federation for American Immigration Reform between 1986, I believe, and 2003, somewhere in that avenue.
So you're talking about Richard Mellon Scaife, the guy who was so hot to get Bill Clinton nailed.
That's correct.
Okay.
And it's interesting you bring that up, Derek, because there's a caveat I need to throw in here at this point. And all, just because he was out to get Bill Clinton doesn't make him a patriot. And all that shows is what we have asserted since the beginning of our research, that the power elite is not a monolithic group like Spectre with a bald-headed Donald Pleasant sitting at the center of it all stroking a cat. That stuff's great for in Fleming fiction, but in reality, the establishment is a network built on the precepts of oligarchy and elitism that an elite can work through to consolidate their own personal power and to interface with other elites when their objectives and their aims match up. That being said, there's feuding and there's fighting between the elites. You know, new money hates old, the old money hates new money, and old line dynasties see the new line dynasties as intrusive Johnny come latelys, and that's all that was between Scaife and Clinton was a fighting between elite factions. And when you look at Scaife's background, you see this background that's just steeped in the intelligence community. Richard Mellon Scaife himself headed up an organization called Forum World Features, and it was a publishing organ, and many different whistleblowers have named it as a CIA front. And also going back further in time to the CIA's parent, the forerunner to the CIA, OSS, Richard Mellon Scaife's father, Alan Scaife, was a lieutenant colonel in the OSS. Paul Mellon, who was a cousin to Scaife's mother, was a major in the OSS, and he worked under Alan Dulles. And then Paul Mellon's brother-in-law, David Bruce, was a member of the OSS and oversaw all the OSS operations that were in Europe and was given that position by Wild Bill Donovan, William Donovan, who was the OSS's head. And then David Bruce's second wife, Evangeline, was an OSS secretary. And then another member of the family, Larimer Mellon, was another OSS member that was in the family. So this is probably where Richard Mellon Scaife learned the trick of using philanthropy as he does, because he's got he gives a lot of money to a lot of different causes, but he's basically using philanthropy as a cover for intelligence projects. And that's probably what we have going on here.
Not to mention that Scaife also has a preoccupation with population control. He's also contributed money to Planned Parenthood, if I'm not mistaken.
That's That's correct.
And again, this dovetails with the objectives and the beliefs of Tanton and his allied neo-Malthusian ideologues.
But one thing I should throw in here, when I was going to school in the local area at a community college that I go here, that I've attended here, I had a teacher that taught me criminal justice and constitutional law who is also a judge in the area, and he had worked for the Central Intelligence Agency back during his days in Vietnam. He was recruited first during his college years to work for them, and then again he was recruited later on in Vietnam out of the Marines to basically act like he was a Canadian running a trading post that was doing trade with the indigenous population. And he basically talked to the NVA guys that would come to this post and basically report back on troop movements in the hills, and they'd end up bombing this hill or that hill, you know, based on his intelligence gathering. But something that one of the things that he taught me was that when you get with the Central Intelligence Agency, you're basically a lifer.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that Scaife, whether or not he is stopped or, you know, with this whole World Forum features being a front organization or not, he can be called upon in the future by the CIA and probably still very much in bed with those guys. See, I mean, because you're basically stuck for life. When you, once with the agency, you're always with the agency.
So you've got these CIA-connected wealthy Americans who are using their money to fund John Tanton, who is taking that money then and using it to translate into boots on the ground on the border, or what's he doing with this to infiltrate and influence the movement?
How does he benefit from that?
Well, essentially, by steering, first off, through the Tanton Network and its subsumption of organizations like the Minutemen, he can steer it down a neo-Malthusian direction. He can steer it onto a neo-Malthusian trajectory and direct its efforts towards things like population control and confuse the illegal immigration issue and immigration level issue with population and environmental issues. Moreover, they can the neo-Nazi and white supremacist factions that seem to be coming into the fold, so to speak, can possibly potentially radicalize the Minutemen. And if that happens, then you'll have essentially a wonderful little antithesis to pit off the thesis of the Aslan movement.
Mm-hmm.
And create a socially and politically expedient racial dialectic, which of course would lead to all sorts of wonderful little things like a race war and the declaration of martial law, the suspension of constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
And all things that would prove most convenient for individuals like Scaife and other factions of the power elite.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you an example of how this mind poisoning has already probably started to happen. When I was on the October 3rd show of A Closer Look with Michael Corbin, Joe McCutcheon got on board as well as one of the interviewees. And he began to say, first I was saying one of the ways that we can fix this situation is by getting America independent in terms of energy and get us off of being dependent on foreign sources for our fuel and for our energy, and that would begin to help the whole immigration situation, because America has a tendency to turn a blind eye to illegal immigration coming across the border because we're so dependent on oil from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And if we, so, I mean, America hasn't set up a new refinery here since 1975.
Right.
So, I mean, if we were to begin to get these independent refineries off the ground by you know, maybe tax breaks or incentives to new up-and-coming businesses and to new American entrepreneurs and whatnot, we could be basically tell Mexico where to get off and begin to start getting stricter with the with our immigration policy and not worry about them turning the tap off. Well, Joe McCutcheon's responded by saying, well, that's not going to help anything because oil has already peaked and all. Well, the whole peak oil thing, I fell for that at one time. I fell for that at one time, but now I'm starting to see where it's basically a lie.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole peak oil crowd is being used is to kind of give this anti-immigration idea a boost and a kick.
Not only is it giving the anti-immigration it's given the anti-immigration agenda kind of co-opting it, but it's also bringing back to the public discourse the issues of population control. One geologist by the name of Colin Campbell has pretty much openly, one of his big issues is peak oil. He has pretty much advocated policies of population control of what could be characterized as eugenical regimentation of society in order to get consumption levels under control.
And Colin Campbell is also kind of considered the founding father of peak oil, and in his writings he has said that one of the remedies, one of the things to help ease the pressure from oil production peaking is to have zero immigration whatsoever, whether legitimate or illegitimate. So you see, we already have this kind of poisoning of you know, immigration activist minds, you know, and I really take it that Joe McCutcheon is a well-meaning
mm-hmm.
guy, but
yeah.
You see, the duping has already started mm-hmm. in a lot of respects.
So it's no longer about just just protecting the border against people coming across that we don't, and you know, without knowing who they are or their background. Information I have indicates that as many as a third of the people crossing the border illegally who are caught and released by the Border Patrol are other than Mexican.
That's correct.
So it's no longer about that, but thanks to the influence of guys like Tanton and through his supporters in the power elite, it's becoming an issue of survival because of the
yes.
pressure of population on our natural resources.
Absolutely.
And our precious bodily fluids. No, I'm sorry.
Exactly. And it's taking on this kind of a very scary Darwinian tone to it.
Yeah.
In fact, in a recent newsletter put out by Colin Campbell, where he was discussing measures on dealing with peaking oil production and basically the reduction of immigration, his references to Darwinism throughout it are just prolific. And he says that basically the moral absolutes might have had meaning in a pre-Darwinian age, but now we're living in a Darwinian era, and those moral absolutes are basically anachronistic constructs that just need to be discarded in favor of survival.
In other words, it's either them or it's us.
Exactly, exactly. And so what you have is essentially a kind of green ecological feudalism, essentially a scientific dictatorship.
Agenda 21.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
The rewilding of America.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Now, on the other side of this dialogue, dialectic. You've got the Aslan movement.
That's correct. And the Aslan movement is really like a Chicano Nazi group. I mean, literally. The motto of one of the groups that comprise the Aslan cult, the Movimiento Estudiantil Chicano de Aslan, their motto is for the race, everything, outside of the race, nothing. And, you know, I know that with us, we're basically an amalgam of Irish and German with just a little smidgen of Native American running down our father's side. I mean, not enough to even constitute 2%, though. So for us, it would be nothing.
And, yeah.
You know, and this the result of the Aztlan cult's propaganda for the doctrine of La Reconquista can be even felt in Mexico, where there was a Zogby International poll in 2002 taken in Mexico, where 58% of the Mexicans said that they believed that the southwestern United States belongs to Mexico. And 57%, I believe, 57% said that they shouldn't have to ask U.S. permission to enter America at all.
Yeah. Not to mention that a great many of the Aztlan movement and the promulgation of their doctrines has been financed by none other than the Ford Foundation. So, I mean, again,
One of the prime movers and shakers in the Aztlan cult, Henry Santi Estevan, said that if it wasn't for the Ford Foundation, that they would basically be nowhere by now. And if you look more and more into the money that's poured in, the whole movement ceases to look Chicano as much as it does just to be of the Ford Foundation in its entirety. I believe that the whole Southwest Council of La Raza that Henry Santi Estevan headed up is basically nothing more than a Ford Foundation front.
So essentially now, you take this apart. You take apart the racial dialectic. Remove the race dimension for a moment. Remove white, Chicano, blacks, whatever. Remove that from the formula. What do you have? You have neo-Nazis neo-Nazis and white supremacists on one hand who adhere to a national socialism. You have the Chicano radicals of the Aztlan movement on the other hand who adhere to a Marxist doctrine which is essentially socialism. Exactly. Behind this racial dialectic, the racial dialectic disguises a broader Hegelian dialectic, and that good old Hegelian dialectic is the Hegelian dialectic of communism versus fascism.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who's done their homework knows that really communism and fascism really amount to little more than variants of the same socialist totalitarian system.
Right.
Even etymologically, take apart the names. Communism comes from the Latin word communis, which means group. Fascism comes from the Italian word fascio, which means group. Both are forms of coercive group living or collectivism. And really the only difference between fascism and communism is fascism's ostensible observance of private property rights, which is really limited by government regulation. So your private property rights are really a mirage. So essentially the race war that the elite could be possibly engineering at this moment amounts to little more than a Hegelian dialectic designed to bring about state socialism.
And if this was merely just some street thugs, we wouldn't really have to worry about it. But there are people, movers and shakers, that have gotten involved in this dialectic that can really make things happen now. In particular, in the California area, one of the things we see happening if this whole thing doesn't get cleaned up with the Minutemen is all hell breaking loose in California. For instance, Governor Schwarzenegger came forward with his support for the Minutemen and all. Well, what most people don't realize is that Schwarzenegger's father, Gustav Schwarzenegger, was a brown shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And Schwarzenegger has said some really supportive things of Nazism. I remember back during his days of bodybuilding, when he was doing one of these bodybuilding tours, he was in Germany doing this one bodybuilding outing, and he got up on stage and he basically did the Nazi Sieg Heil, the salute.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of his posing, and the audience booed him, and he got off stage and basically he was really angry, and he said, "These people are nothing without an Austrian to lead them." And you know, he's really got these fascistic kind of tendencies of the Nazi flavor. But then you have in L.A. the mayor there, Antonio Villaraigosa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He
mm-hmm.
won in 2005 the mayoral race, and he's a member of the Movimiento Estudiantil mm-hmm. Chicano de Aztlán. So you got these guys that are now in powerful positions on both sides of the fence, and that can mobilize the people into this kind of race war situation.
Mm. It's going to be really interesting to watch, and guys, we're just about out of time, but I think you've done a nice job of pulling these threads together. It's a complex web, and they make it that way so that it's difficult for people who are trying to lead average lives and just put food on the table and you know, act like normal human beings can't really catch what's going on.
Brain hurts. Hard to understand. Must go football now.
Yeah, must watch the latest episode of Lost.
Watch Danny Bonaducci shoot steroids into his butt.
Hey, listen, guys, will you come back?
Sure.
We'd like to have you back, like, really in the next week or two to follow up on this, because I have a feeling that this is going to be in the news again.
Sure,
and,
sure.
Yeah, discuss other things as well, because it's always a fascinating conversation when we have the time to talk.
I know.
Yep. Paul Collins and Philip Collins, their article is "The Ruling Class-Sponsored Race War and the Balkanization of America." It is available at the Conspiracy Archive, and we will put a link to it in the show notes. Paul, Philip, thank you again for your time and for being with us on PID Radio.
Thanks so much for having us.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
WID Radio. Catherine Adamson thought she was going back to her quiet hometown of Eden, Indiana, to settle the affairs of her late Aunt Celeste. Instead, she discovers that Eden has literally gone to hell. Two high school students have disappeared, leaving behind only a running car and a bloody shoe. Strange lights have appeared over the town, and the fields of a local farm are marked with blackened circles. Eden County Hospital reports record births, incredibly large babies joining the ranks of a growing number of giants. Many of Eden's leading citizens have been hiding evil secrets, but their behavior has been closely watched by the mysterious Dr. Apollo Bell, head of the Mount Hermon Institute. All of Eden is a war camp, and citizens must choose sides in an eternal battle. Catherine is reunited with her old flame, Joshua Carpenter, the publisher of the Eden Chronicle. They quickly learn their strongest ally may be John Thundercloud, a legless old Winnebago Indian who spends his days writing line after line in a library full of tattered diaries. It's Winds of Evil by Sharon K. Gilbert, book one of the Laodicea Chronicles. Available now online and at bookstores everywhere.
They're coming from the darkness. Over 6,000 years ago, the citizens of Mesopotamia encountered them.
Down through time, tens of thousands of people on every continent of the world have etched their likeness on the walls of caves, chiseled statues of them from solid stone, and prayed prayers to their highest gods to be delivered from them.
But prophecy says they will return, and at a time when Babylon, modern Iraq, and Iran is invaded and destroyed. This spring, exclusively from RaidersNewsUpdate.com, we'll tell you what you need to know about them. In the book-length ebook, Stargates, Ancient Rituals, and Those Invited Through the Portal.